Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
People of Earth, attention.
Calling Tau City. Turn on your radio. I know we had some words last time, but that was so long ago. I got your message. It was a little harsh, you know. It's still a little hard for me to hear. Please take it slow.
Welcome to Starship Sofa, part of the District of Wonders network. Everyone has a story in the District of Wonders. Come and find yours.
I'm tuning in to your transmissions. I'm a hoon and waiting to be found. And I'm building rockets.
This is the Starship Sova. Everybody, welcome. Hello and welcome to show 638. I am your host, Tony C. Smith. Hello, everyone. I hope everyone is fine and dandy. Welcome back to Starship Sova. Yes, we are still heading into deep space with number 638. I'll tell you what's coming in today's show. We have the main fiction, which is Seven Letters by Amy Ogden. And this is an original to Starship Sova. That is all coming in today's show. I do hope you will stick around and enjoy it. So like I say, we have an original to Starship Sova today. Yes, Seven Letters by Amy Ogden. Amy Ogden is a former science teacher and software tester. She now writes stories about sad astronauts and angry princesses. Her short fiction has also appeared in Analog, Fireside, Beneath the Skies, and her novella Local Star is forthcoming from Interstellar Flight Press. Now, this story is narrated by Summer Brooks, who is a story addict who watches too much television. She enjoys putting her encyclopedia sci-fi geek knowledge to the test in discussions about sci-fi, horror and comics. She's been doing just that on Slice of Sci-Fi since 2005 as a co-host, producer, host and EIC, and as the Babylon podcast co-host from 2006 to 2012. Summer is also an avid reader and writer of science fiction, fantasy and thrillers, with a handful of published credits to her name. Next on her agenda is writing an urban fantasy action adventure and a monster movie extravaganza. She also narrates for Tales to Terrify and Escape Pod, amongst others, and has doing audiobooks in her sights. So, the Starship Sova is very proud to present.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Seven Letters by Amy Ogden. T. In 10 years, Damya would go home again as a refugee, a victor, a pilgrim. Today, though, now, though on the sickly backwater world to which she'd fled, there was no hope of that kind of future, no hope at all. She huddled under the rough blankets that the strangers here offered her. She closed her eyes when their incomprehensible imperial dialect rolled over her, arguing over her fate, most likely. However far she fled from the ambit, some things could never change. Somewhere in the tangled wilds of Sosova, the light courier craft she'd stolen grew cold beneath the double moon. The empty fuel canisters she'd jettisoned in the atmosphere would offer shelter to local flora and fauna. It could not be far outside this little town, over which broken imperial towers still stood like the memories of the dead. It seemed impossible that she could ever find the thing again, though. Not without staggering back through dreams and darkness, the same way she'd come. "Do you know who I am?" she asked them, on the cusp of a broken bubble of hysteria. Of course they didn't know who the Imperial Laureate was. That was why she'd come here across hollow, wasted space. They didn't know who the Imperatrix was, either. When she could open her mouth again, only the reach of the spires came out, and the strange people with their strange talk fell silent. It was the old version, the one written for the celebration of the 50th year of the Imperatrix's reign, and Damya gagged on the forced Hendeka syllables. She bent her neck and vomited on the floor between her feet. The man who'd brought her here, into this strange little house, was named Ale, she thought. She had tried to steal fruit from his market stand, and he'd struck with his fist, then picked her up in his arms and carried her here. His home? What passed for a prison here? Wherever it was, this place could not be worse than what accommodations the ambit would have offered her. Damya's face ached. The parts of her that had once been hailed as laureate, inscribed couplets in the medium of bruised skin and flesh, praised the incandescence of pain over the absence of sensation. But the rest of her, flensed back to base animal instinct, and wiser for it, flinched away from Ale when he shimmered in front of her like a mirage, both here and not. In his hands he held a stoneware cup of black liquid that roiled like a fever dream. The white steam made Damya cough when she breathed it in, and the people behind Ale murmured until a stern word from him cut the silk ribbon of their whispers short. He folded her hands tightly around the cup and said firmly, "Delelorca." Then he touched Damya's throat and nodded at her. "Telelorca," she croaked back to him, and he bared his teeth in a smile. It was the first sliver of Sosovan she would learn, and some day she might yet learn to mean it, too. But not yet, not for these lean gifts. Thank you. Kay. It took 2 years of saving before Damya could afford a boat of her own. Imperial Credit did not spend here. Elay and his husband, her saviors, her only friends, found her a job as a common sailor on a fishing boat, and her accounting in Sasovan coins grew slowly over that time. She learned more than how to best apply a mop to a ship's deck, though she did learn that, and learned it well. From the languid chatter of the sailors, she began to muster her own small army of Sasovan syllables, albeit a despairingly ungrammatical one. She learned the vagaries of the ocean and its complex patterns of high tides and low, and how to navigate by Sasovan skies. She learned to stop using the word Sasovan altogether. And replace it with Crete Loala Ratoe. That was what they called themselves now, after 6,000 years separation from the imperial ambut. Sasova was only an imaginary word on an imperial star chart. Instead, it should be Crete Loalara, an ugly little word for an ugly little place, a string of half-hearted cities around the thick waistline of a shady world orbiting a dusty pink sun. Damya thought she could come to quite hate the place, given the opportunity. But more than she hated Sasova, she hated the shining black cities of the Koliatura. She hated the spires of the Imperial Tower. She hated the sweltering and too bright cells at the fortress's high reaches. She hated the idea that she might find herself so imprisoned one day for the Imperatrix's judgment to be seared into her skin on the breath of each sunrise. As it would be seared onto Xaros each day, since Damya's escape and every day in the future. But no use thinking of that now. Sailing was the first physical labor she had performed since her days as a scholast. The work was a chance to learn many things, and it was a chance to forget many more. When she told her captain that she had earned enough to pay for her own boat, the other woman did not congratulate Damya or become angry. She only said, "Hang the mop up to dry before you go." And then, as Damya stood absorbing the send-off, fishing, bad business, too many storms. And off she went before Damya could begin to guess whether she was joking or serious. The years hadn't offered her much instruction on the Crelo Alaratue concept of humor. Elay came down to the docks while she was putting her own touch on her boat in preparation for its inaugural voyage. Her assigned berth lay in the ragged shadow of the old imperial bridge that had once spanned the bay inlet, before the river had changed its course. Here and there along the shore, the husks of white-shelled imperial towers still stood over dark slate roofs. Sasova had forgotten that the ambit had once touched these shores, but Damya could not help but remember. When she hailed him, Elay set down the baskets of fruit that he would sell at the morning market and leaned over the rail to squint at the rust-red letters she'd painted on the aluminum hull. "Ambit's Reach," she'd written, in imperial script. "Rain washes everything away," Elay said. He reached down and smeared the first letter, whose paint had not quite dried. "Not good to get too attached to a thing. It's a boat. It's not a child. It's not a lover." The people here did not care overmuch for their boats, not even enough to remove the buildup of decay that sent each ship to the harbor bottom. Damya thought that if she took care to scrape the hull once every few days, she might save the trouble of buying a new boat every year or two, as the rest of the fishing fleet did. She'd save money, build a miniature fleet of her own. Fish was a staple food, and it paid well enough. Better yet if you didn't sink a small fortune along with your ship every few months. "I know, it's a boat." As with its abbreviated syllables, The language lent itself best to simple sentences. Anything more complex gave Damya a headache. Layers upon layers of verb expansions and noun declensions. When she'd fled here, she had half expected a language barrier she could step over with a bit of a stretch, like reading from pre-imperial texts in the Biblio Antiquity collection. But Sisylvan, already a half-branch dialect from Middle Imperial, had become a meaningless garble to speakers of Her Majesty's native tongue. The imperial alphabet of 22 letters had dwindled down to a mere 7, and those remaining declined to arrange themselves in any fashion that Damya could comprehend. She had commanded words once. She had written the face of worlds, raised the classes to arms, and brought low those who would undermine the ambit's glory. And of course, she had brought down the wrath of the Imperatrix. Only once, though. What had the charges been? Ah, yes, criminal harm to the honor and dignity of Her Imperial Majesty. She retouched the letter that Elay had marred. And it's my boat. In my home, ships have names. Elay considered this. Your house has a name? Well, no. Damya's mouth twisted. The long-range courier she had bought on the black market, gutted and fled with, had only an assigned call number. It had been a life raft, and you didn't hang a name on a life raft any more than you nailed a certificate of the Imperatrix's household blessing to its walls. But this name makes me laugh. Not strictly true. There wasn't much to laugh about when it came to the ambit. It made her smile, though. A hard smile that stretched her lips over her teeth. That would have to do. Elay peered at the letters, which would make as much sense to him upside down as right side up. Not very funny, he said. Probably bad luck, too. I don't know. Never seen anyone do it before. So it's a... Damya didn't know the word auspicious in Kretlo Alaratoe. A good day for you. Elay moved aside as she scrambled over the railing. There. Now I'm ready to be a productive citizen. A real Kretlo Alaratoe at last. Now Elay did laugh, and laugh, and laugh. Damya might have been offended if she weren't so confused. Ah, Tareya, he said finally. That was the best he could do when it came to her name. He laid one hand on the back of her neck and patted it, a familial sensation, though they were very nearly of an age. Dear one, you aren't Kretlo Alaratoe. You are Keloala. Keloala. She'd heard the word before, but then so many words sounded the same. Perhaps the accent had fallen on a different syllable and rewritten the meaning entirely. What does that mean? It means... Elay scrunched his brows and closed his eyes. Then he shrugged one shoulder up and down. It means not Kretlo Alaratoe. Well, what did that mean? Alien? Foreigner? Elay pursed his lips at Damya's sour look and tapped her behind the ear with two fingers. A familiar gesture, literally. Damya had never seen two adult Kretlo Alaratoe rail do it to one another. Only parents to their children. We are ourselves, Tareya. That is all. And what am I? Hungry. Relola is back from the hunt. Arrowbird for dinner tonight. He'll be happy to see you. Of course, you are coming for dinner. Getting steamrolled by Elay could be frustrating, but today Damya smiled and enlisted him to help pull the tarp over the boat to protect it from the evening's rain. They walked down the docks side by side. Not only had Relola brought in a string of arrow birds, but he had landed a bearded claw beast, one of the large leather-scaled reptile-adjacent creatures that burrow deep in the tangle wilds. Claw beasts could be vicious. Two hunters had died last year after chancing upon a nest, and Ale made a spectacle of furious fussing over Relola, which Relola seemed pleased to take as his due. He cleaned his prize in the yard behind their little house, in between the back wall and Ale's fruit bushes. A small crowd of young onlookers stared from the street at the flash of his knife and the strength in his arms as he hefted the carcass up to hang from a tree branch. "No clawbeef steaks tonight," he told Alay and Damya, who sat to the side drinking cups of arak, Damya's contribution to the meal. "Clawbeef needs to cure for a week. Curing draws all the toxins out." Kretloalaratoe didn't have much in the way of expressions of contingency. "Relola is cooking," Damya said, and sipped her arak. This was good arak, fermented flowers and nectar. She couldn't say for certain it was as good as the honey wine she'd had back home, but she couldn't say it was worse either. She wouldn't have minded a cup of each to make the direct comparison. "When Ale cooks, I go home early." Relola laughed, but Ale only stretched. Arak dripped from the rim of his cup and ran unheeded down over his fingers. "I can be patient for claw beast," he said, "but your arrow birds suffer for the comparison." "Ah," Relola stripped the last of the skin from the carcass. "Now a week's worth of sun would destroy the deadly chemicals in the claw beast's flesh. Bird or beast, it's all Keloala. You are grateful to your excellent husband for such a fine meal." He wiped his hands on his pants and pointed at the flask. "Now, pour me some of that arak. I have to stand over a hot stove. I won't be thirsty standing over a hot stove." The familiar word he'd used pulled Damya up out of the depths of her arak. Keloala, not Kretloalaratoe. The claw beasts, the arrow birds, and Damya. She stared into the dead thing's glassy amber eyes and did not look up when Relola went into the house for a clean shirt. Later, after the sun had set and the bones had been picked clean and a bottle of arak had been emptied, Relola sat beside the yellow fire and sang. He had a lovely voice, one that would have served well to sing the morning and evening hours from the heights of the Koliatura. But it was good to have that voice filling only the warm, close space of the yard and not echoing in a great hollow city. When a Kretloalaratoe man sang, mostly it was men, the women sang only working songs, at least where Damya could hear, he omitted the already scarce consonants. Only the vowels, open-mouthed and true, rang out from Relola's mouth. A beautiful sound, though it did make trying to absorb the music's meaning a challenge for Damya. She frowned into her empty cup, trying to divine some understanding, and did not notice when Ele leaned in until he spoke. "I call you Keloala," he said. "You are not Kretloalaratoe. To name you Keloala is not an unkindness. Keloala is a truth." He settled back in his chair. "You worship this grasping elder. No word for imperatrix here, of course. The seeds of your life, seeds buried and gone. Keloala hoard for winter. Not Kretloalaratoe. Dreams stacked up high, dreams to fill the sky. No, dreams do not build bridges, Tareya. Not across puddles, not between worlds." Anger flared up wetly behind her eyes. There was every reason to be angry with the Imperial Ambit and no opportunity to express it. Being upset with Ale was convenient, but pointless. She blinked rage away and tried to cast her own fortune for her own benefit as much as his. I am not Cretloalaratoe. She struggled for a way to express her future, her immense potentiality, in the few sharp syllables afforded her. Then she changed tacks. I make myself Cretloalaratoe. I make myself. I work hard on the boat. I earn money. I write again in Cretloalaratoe. People love my work and listen. When she heard herself say it aloud, she knew it was true, or rather, that it would be. That was her gift, wasn't it? Words that knew the power of truth. And then, I am Cretloalaratoe. Ale, who reached out and patted her cheek. His eyes were amber like the claw beast's, but not clouded like its were. And what she saw in that clear view made her turn her head. Back to Relola, back to open, empty sounds of song. He sings beautifully, she said, to change the subject. No, said Ele. Relola sings like a goat in heat. He lifted a hand and pointed three fingers at his husband. But when the god comes down upon him, the god sings beauty. And for a little while, I am married to a god. He smiled and opened his arms to Relala and spread his legs as well. Relala approached, still singing, and climbed onto Ele's lap. His voice rolled to Damia along the curve of Ele's neck, and even when Ele's mouth found his, that did not stop the melody, only changed the almost words of O's and E's into a breathy staccato ah-ah-ah. When they began to rub against each other, Relala's pelvis atop Ele's, Damia was too drunk to get up and walk home, and too tired to hold their behavior up to imperial standards of modesty. She watched them in the fading shadows from the fire, and Relala's song echoed in the hollow spaces where she had once carried Xaro. E. Among the Cretloalaratoereo, the working day was 4 hours long. At least this was true in the town where Damia had made her home. She had never taken her ship bound home to the skies again to see if Cretloalaratoe was Cretloalaratoe, no matter where on this forgotten world you went. 4 hours appeared to be the length of time a man or woman of the village could work and make enough money to afford a normal lifestyle, as well as the lengthy stretch of luxury time to which people here accustom themselves. To Damia, who had worked 6-hour days as a laureate and 12 to 14 between the study rooms and the chore list as a scholast, this lifestyle seemed sluggish at best and indolent at worst. A full 10 hours on her boat let her amass money quickly, and she saved what she didn't need to spend on survival. She saw Ele and Relola and their friends less often, but within months she had enough to buy a second ship and to pay others to staff it, too. Finding willing employees, however, proved to be the problem. She posted messages on the local data group and tacked them up in analog on the posts and pillars of the marketplace. Finally, she asked Ele over to her home for a bowl of her best silver-scale stew. And while they ate in the shadow of the vine-grown spacecraft, she asked whether her solicitations, painstakingly written in her best Cretloalaratoe, had some error or awkward wording she had missed. "Nothing is wrong with your words, Tyrea," Ele said, and set his tablet aside, face down. His lips twisted, half-smile, half-frown, an expression Damia had long since grown used to. "The problem is the shape your words make. We enjoy our ekeloale, that's all. You know Ekeloele? Of course I know. Rest, relaxation.
Sloth?
Peace and quiet. No. Ele sighed. And yes. He scratched his belly while staring off into the middle distance. Damya didn't press him. When she nagged for answers, he tended to clam up entirely. Relola was more forthcoming, but off on the hunt again. She worried about him, out there among the claw beasts and tree cats all by himself at his age. But Ele had never seemed concerned, so she tried to contain her fears. Ekeloele is time to be a person. That's ridiculous. I'm still a person working. Explanations burned away in the heat of Damya's irritation. She fumbled for simple sentences among the ashes. My brain thinks. My body is mine. Ele tapped two fingers on his open palm, a gesture of rebuke. This one she seemed to see more and more often as the days lengthened into summer. Perhaps that was her temper's fault, and not Ele's. She was still not accustomed to weather so warm, not after all her years in the weather-controlled dome beneath the Coleatura's spires. No. A man working is Keloala. He needs money for food, shelter. He wants comfort and safety. He is nothing but need and want. Later, he stops and breathes. He comes back to himself. Now he is human again. Damya stood up. She dusted off her pants, collected the bowls. Ele's stew was cold and barely touched, and put them inside. When she came back out, Ele still sat with his hands on his belly, and she thought she could speak to him without shouting. Your rules change all the time, she said. You are Keloala only while you work, but I am Keloala all of the time? He watched her in silence, then leaned forward. His arms braced his knees, both thinner than they had been when she had first met him. She ought to have him over more often while Reloala was away. Who knew what he was eating otherwise? You are forever striving, Tareya. I don't know its name. The name of the thing you strive for. You never name your striving to me. You never name your striving to Relala. Or he never tells me the name of your sadness. He reached out and curled his fingers around hers. You are not Keloala because you work hard. You work hard because you are Keloala. Do you see? Damya said, It's late. You've eaten enough? Kretloalaratoe's intonation left her words ambiguous, half question, half statement. Ele put his hands on his own knees and pushed to a stand. His bones creaked, and Damya cringed, for him and her own weary limbs. I am old, he announced. To the night or to her, it didn't much matter. My bones tell me lies. What do they tell me? I am a helpful man. Oh, the lies echo in the cage of my ribs. Can I not set them free? To be Keloala is a weary thing. There is no fault in the deafness of the Keloala. There is no fault in the silver scale who struggles in the net or the tree cat pinned by arrows. He rested one hand on her shoulder, just for a moment, then turned and walked off into the lengthening shadows. She watched him go, stooped shoulders half hiding his gray head, and did not go back into her ship until the evening swallowed him up. Damya went back out on her boat the next morning. She did not post any more requests for employees, and she did not purchase a second vessel. Ele did not come to see her off, not that day and not the next. She turned the bow out into the wide harbor, cast her nets, and dragged in her catch, threw back the fish that would not sell. Out of some sense of defiance, or spite, which was really only another name for defiance turned sour, she had her boat back in its slip by the noon hour. But when she went to the marketplace, she kept close to the dockside, and did not walk down to the far end where the fruit sellers hawked their wares. And since she did not have Elé or Elola's house to visit, she spent those spare hours in her own silent home. She listened to the scraps of music and dramas that trickled through the ansible. She silenced the damnable thing when sweet-voiced singers delivered the good news of the Imperatrix's mercy and grace. On the fourth day, alone and angry and weary of silence, she took down her data block and scrawled the epigram with which she had opened Meditations on the Last Month of the 12th Year of the Reign of Her Imperial Majesty. Then she erased those words with a flick of her thumb. And then, for the first time since coming to Crete Loalara, she wrote something new. She wrote it in halting Crete Loalaratoe. Simple words, simple cadences. A misshapen little poem to her eyes, but it would do. It would have to. She revised it once, then read it aloud in all its staccato glory. She had to manually retype it in order to upload it to Elé's account, as her data block was hardly compatible with local standards. The final version of Keloala read, "The honeybee lacks the thinking mind's wisdom to come in from the working day, but she may yet learn to linger on a single flower. Bees and men are not kin, but we are good to one another." She sent the file and turned back to her data block, hoping more words would flow behind these first few. But a chime from the local system made her turn back. An error. Elé's account had declined her file. Perhaps he'd blocked incoming messages from her. She gnawed her lip like an anxious teenager, then straightened her shoulders like the seasoned woman she was. She could apologize for her temper face to face. She'd had plenty of opportunities for that with Xara once upon a time, though she was rather out of practice anymore. Less than a week, and it was already an unfamiliar feeling to walk the dirt street that wound around the outskirts of the city, out to Elé and Relola's house. She carried a bottle of arrak under one arm and a string of fish slung over the other, a double offering, flesh and blood. When she drew close, she heard voices, raised in cheer and a little drunkenness. In spite of herself, she prickled. She knew she wasn't their only companion, but something of the merriment going on behind her back, a back she had turned even so, had the sting of ambit gossip and backroom politicking. No, there was none of that here. Elé did not scheme and snipe, and if she was his and Relala's family pet, at least she was a fondly kept one. She relaxed the set of her jaw. Clenched teeth could be construed as rude in polite Kreloalaratue company, or perhaps a sexual come-on, or perhaps both. When she strolled up to their front gate, her head was high and her smile easy. Elé was nowhere in sight, but Relola held court on the lawn with more guests than Damia had ever seen at his house. A sort of buffet had been laid out scattershot, clawbeast talons to suck the marrow from, jelly sauce and a pile of puffy loaves as high as Damia's knee, bowls of sour fruits and pickled fish. When Damia laid her hand on the gate, Relala looked up and lifted his cup. "Ah!" he cried. "Elle est new. She comes. She always comes. When few words are left, only the truth comes out." "What few words?" The conversation split apart on either side of Damia as she approached Relala where he sat on the porch, this half-talking about what the weather meant for the Lorelorot harvest. That half-talking about whether an unnamed cousin was finally going to marry her long-suffering fiancé. Damya held out the arrak and the fish, her suddenly paltry offering, and Relala accepted them with a gracious murmur. Why is everyone here? Where is Ele hiding? Not hiding, Tareya. Relala smiled and uncapped the arrak. The weathered hollows of his neck throbbed with the long swallow he drew. To hide is active, to avoid being found. You can find Ele in the house. He waits there. He doesn't hide. He smiled still as she walked past him and into the house, where the door stood open. The cool evening wind ruffled the hangings on the walls and the leaves of the garden alike, no real barrier between the two. He smiled, so she knew, but did not expect to find Ele laid out on the bed, arms folded across his chest. He smiled too, as knowingly as his husband, but more peacefully. On the table beside him rested an empty cup, which gave off a toxic whiff of lelele root. She wondered if he'd grown it in his own gardens or bought it from the apothecary in the marketplace. And since she didn't know what else to do, she curled his stiff fingers around the data block and left it, left him, left the room behind. She shut the door on the way out, but one of the other guests jumped up to open it again and shouted at her in a rapid jumble of Krelo Alaratawe that stung Damya's eyes and ears alike. I don't understand, she said, and it was Relala, of course, who sucked his teeth and took pity on her. Stomach cancer. He walked the path of Oala Teleolau. It took her a moment to place that word. It contained roots related to death and gratitude alike. Planned suicide. Relala patted the stoop beside him, but Damya did not sit. Her aching bones might not stir again if she settled there, and she wasn't prepared to make that concession. There's no grieving now. The doors are open. Ele has flown. He studied her from under his dark, pointed brows. He has been flying for a long time. Now the tether is cut. He didn't say goodbye. Tareya, said Relala. He said goodbye to us, has been saying goodbye to us, ever since the day we met him. He held out the bottle of arrak, well on its way to half empty now. She took it, and her legs bent beneath her, as if by Relola's volition and not her own. R. The Relelorat bushes in the garden foundered without Ale's touch. At first, Damya had a mind to tend them herself, but her efforts proved fruitless in more ways than one. They were a fussy plant, bred in the days when Sosova had belonged to the Ambit, before the cataclysm had divided the system from all but its closest cousins. She'd tried to explain to Relola the nature of the gamma ray burst that had wiped worlds off the map and rewritten Imperial shipping lanes. To fit Kretloralara into a greater context. But he told her, Kretloala was the only context necessary to understand his life. To understand hers, too. But what had it been like in this place in the years after its severance from the Ambit? As Imperial technology failed and Imperial infrastructure crumbled. Damya wondered if those dark years were why the Kretloalaratawe still responded to statements of, but this is the shape of things, somewhere long ago, someplace far away, with disinterest and disdain. A nearly hereditary impatience with how things had been in favor of how they were now. Perhaps that was why the garden struggled, too. Damya devoted her efforts to guessing how Elay would have done things. She ought to have sought out what would best serve her now. The Raleigh-Lorat's chief failing was that it was not self-fertilizing. Of course, Elay had learned the fruit grower's arts in his long-ago schooling. He had never shared them with Damya nor Relola. The bushes went to flower, shed their petals, and failed to come up green again with the spring. Damya cursed the grasping, thorny roots until Relola came out to shoo her along home. The Ambit data block had held up remarkably in its years, without updates or trade-ins. Still, Damya had not suffered to send it to eternal rest alongside Elay. Now when Damya wrote, she wrote on a Kretloalaratoe tablet, or she paid for precious paper and ink and scratched her words out by hand. Thus did she bleed out essays and poems and sagas, seven letters rearranged in infinite combinations. She read her work aloud in artist gatherings at a favorite tavern and at the stationer's shop. There was nowhere to buy books here. If Damya wanted literature, she must either write it herself or go listen to another's recitations. She never received more than a polite murmur, a pat on the head. But she did not write for them, nor even for Elay or Xara. Damya was the imperial laureate, and she wrote for herself. She had still not learned to find the beauty in Kretloalaratoe, and after all this time and such sparse space for it to hide in, perhaps she never would. But there was a certain power and utility in the few sounds available to her, an undeniable flow toward meter, rhythm, inevitability. Relala spent more time in Damya's house now. To escape Elay's ghost? Or to keep a closer eye on her? Or for some other, more obscure reason? She was home more often now, too, scribbling furiously, furious in anger and frantic pace alike. Only 3 or 4 hours in the morning out to sea, and sometimes none at all if she had a spectacular take the day before. When the aluminum boat finally surrendered itself to the harbor, she did not buy another, but sought employment from another seasoned captain. She had enough to buy another boat, but not the desire for one, even if it meant a much smaller take. She bent her back alongside the younger deckhands, and she did not complain when her bones groaned with the weight of a net, and she did not seek more than her share of shifts. While fish writhed at her feet, she composed cinquains. While her mop painted abstract shapes on the deck, she limned an epic, a torch-bearing hero's journey into darkness. But she had no ending for the tale, and so it lived only as an outline in the backmost corners of her mind. Sometimes she read her work aloud to Relola, while he knitted or swept out the broadleaf pollen and stray leaves that had blown into her ship. He rolled his head side to side on his neck, in tempo with her words. An easy nod, yes, Tarea, very nice. His opinion didn't really matter, but it mattered that she offered him the chance to have one. It mattered to her. She didn't know what song played behind those dark hooded eyes, but at least he still included her in the chorus. Only once did he offer her something more, a criticism she could take to heart. Ah, Tarea, he'd sighed, after she'd finished the recitation of a poem about a fishing vessel foundering at sea and parting a pair of young lovers. You go straight from the beginning to the end. From the first line, I know how the story goes. She looked at the first words she'd written again. The harbor, we all know, is a jealous soul. She finishes with her lovers, and she never gives them back after. The argument stayed behind her clamped lips. Arguments with the Kretloalaratoe had never yet gotten her anywhere. You want so badly to get to the ending, Rilola said, and shook his head. You are a very clever Keloala, but you always struggle so hard. You want to get to the ending before the beginning has arrived. Tell us about the clouds, the woman when she was young, her cousins, how she laughed and wrestled with them. When the man first loved her in the forest, that soft moss that caught in their braids and stayed in their clothes for days. No one wants to hear about that, Damya said, and Relola shrugged. It was a cold night in the late spring when Relola brought her a box of marrow candies and a song. Cold enough that he had to rap at the closed door, and she hurried to let him in. A gift, he said, presenting her with the marrow candies. A bit expensive, even for a beloved family pet. But the thought itself was the real kindness. Celebrating one's naming day was an imperial custom, but not a Kretloalaratawe one. She felt 100 years older, not just one, but good company and sweets would ameliorate that. Relola had the latest gossip from his cousins, who lived 2 cities upriver into the north, near the edges of livable territory before the water became undrinkable and the terrain steep. The roads were bad in Province Lato, and the wealthy men and women who had bought their council seats had declined a repair levy. The boat factory downtown would have a brick wall constructed down the middle so that both the daughters of the owner would inherit equally, and the town would be spared a familial battle in the streets. Tekelo, the candy shop owner, sent his greetings. The ship couldn't be heated without igniting the engines along with the trees and the vines that grew up around them. But they huddled together under knit throes, and the gentle glow of scandal and surprise rolling off Relola's stories kept Damya cozy too. Beneath his voice, the ansible crackled with soft background music. Glimmers swam through to Damya when Relola paused for breath. A children's choir, most likely high caste castrati, warbled a hymn to the ambit's reach. Scraps of an interview with a leading imperial geneticist and population planner. And then, in a brief burst, a newscaster reading the regiment council's ruling against the Imperatrix. A decree that stripped her of title, station, and hereditary privileges. And of dignity, Damya thought. Inside her, a bubble of hysterical laughter broke and poured out between her fingers. What had finally tipped the scales? Which counselor's child seduced, used, and not so quietly discarded? Which planetary estate seized and depleted? The outpouring of mania slowed, then dried up. Only when she had calmed herself and convinced Relola of her well-being did he bid her farewell for the night and urge her to take some rest. She didn't even try to explain the nature of the seismic shift that had just occurred billions of miles away. Not a gamma ray burst, but a cataclysm all the same. What would be left when these shards accreted into new shapes? Damya was late to the docks the next morning. Her ship had already put to sea. She went home without wages and lay in the lee of her bunk until the next day's light. Oh. Every day Damya gets up and thinks, maybe today is the day. Every day this thought sends a shiver of possibility through her, of hope, of terror. If Xara has survived these last years, she is not the same woman. The woman whose screams once alerted Damya to the arrival of the Imperatrix's own in their home. Xara has spent time in the sun cells, this is certain. Did that blazing light burn the soul out of her? Or did that come later, in the dark, cool mercy of the Imperatrix's reconditioning core? Either way, it doesn't much matter. No, it must matter. Does Xaro still remember her? Think of her? Does she burn with the deep veins of hatred only conditioning can create? Or does she hate Damia on the true and worthy merit of her own failings, as a wife, a poet, a friend? She spends too much time by the Ansible. Once she and Xaro agreed on a specific band, in case of emergency, in case of trouble. The Ansible picks up this band, but it is as empty as the space between Kretlo Alara and the Ambit's borders. Perhaps in the chaos of the post-Imperatrix vacuum, Xaro cannot reach an Ansible. Perhaps she doesn't want to. Perhaps she has forgotten the band assignation. Perhaps she has forced it from her mind. Damia does not drink from the fountain of news pouring in from other channels. Her lips are chapped from licking, and sometimes she can see through the papery skin of her hands to her bones. They are good bones, she thinks, or they were once. She could hang something worthwhile upon them again, given the right hands to weave it. Her stomach growls. She wonders if she has a job still to go to. It's late, or early. She has plenty of time to get to the docks. She ought to keep up her strength by resting. No, she ought to work so she can buy another day's worth of food. She is old and she is small. A little food can stretch 3 days, four. She paces the length of her ship. There is a knit hat on her bunk. She pulls it over her hair and crams the loose threads up underneath. The wind tugs them back out again when she steps out the door and into the day. Relala used sea strand fiber to make the hat, and it itches where it touches Damia's skin. The door stays open behind her, throwing the empty silence after her. It is cool today. No, not cool. Cold. Her gloves aren't in her pockets. The chill stings her nose. Her hands ache and then they stop. She wonders if the numbness will make it hard to grasp the gutting knife this morning. The boat waits in its slip. No one else is aboard yet, but she climbs over the railing and waits. Snow comes before the sunrise. Not much snow, a gentle dusting of flakes. They nestle in the folds of Damia's jacket and hat. Another pair of sailors arrive next. How much time has passed? They cast glances Damia's way as they start laying out the nets for inspection. O'alateleoa, one of them whispers. But he is wrong. Surely Xaro would not take such a way out. No matter the heat of the sun cells, no matter the terrible secret pain of reconditioning. When the captain arrives, she does not order Damia to work. Damia is glad. Her arms do not remember how to bend and turn with the mop's motion. Her eyes are too dull to spot snags in the nets, and her fingers too slow to fix the damage. But she is also afraid. She needs a job. There are so many holes in her belly, at least one of them can be quieted with food. The captain orders her into the cabin. Damia wonders where she can find a job at her age. She could beg on the street. Some may take pity on a weary Keloala. But the captain shoves Damia into the seat behind the navigation desk. She wraps her jacket around Damia's shoulders. She throws a tin of canned lardfish down in front of Damia and orders her to eat. "You cannot walk the path of O'alateleoal," the captain says, when Damia stares down at the shining yellow-white flesh. "There is no joy in you, no preparation or acceptance. You reject life. You do not embrace death. You are too old to dance away from understanding, Tarea. Stop sliding backwards. Either open your arms to the god of death and smile at her like you mean it, or stand up straight like the grown woman you are and walk back the way you came. When Damya's numb hands struggle with the pull tab on the tin, the captain leans in to help her. Then the lard fish slide down into Damya's belly one by one until only the sheen of grease remains on her tongue, until the space inside her rings a little less hollowly. She pushes back the empty tin, and the captain clears it away. The captain tries to call Relola to come collect Damya, but he is off on a hunting trip beyond reach or response. Damya listens to the dull click of the unanswered line. She says, "I would like to work for a little while." The captain pats Damya on the back of the neck, just below her skull. Damya has never seen one Kretloalaratoe do this to another. She has seen Relola do it to his friend's hunting cats, though. Someone on the crew finds a pair of gloves for her. Waterproof, good leather. Claw beast hide, most likely. She wonders how the poison is drawn out of the leather. Or perhaps it isn't, and it is her body's job to sanitize and clarify. There is an ache in her shoulders as she hauls in the nets of thrashing fish. Her arms tremble, too. But another sailor teaches her a calming chant, an open, rhythmic vowel she has heard from them before. She has never felt entirely welcome to join in. She still doesn't. But the chant binds up the open sore of her mouth, the letter O in monotone, through a wide-open mouth and then through closed teeth, an endless sound looped over by unison with the others at work. Another woman adds her voice as melody. Her sweet vowels dart in and out through the net the other voices are weaving and bind the whole thing together. Damya feels a fierce, illicit joy at being part of this sound. The half-words in the melody singer's voice pull at the edges of her mind with gentle fingers, even without their absent consonants. Fragmented words and a fractional understanding, the same as it ever was. The melody folds back in on itself, a clever turn of phrase with the right intonation. Now the first part of the song is not a lover's call in the night, but a ribald joke. The soft O's of the sailors give way to laughter. Damya does not laugh, but a smile cracks the corners of her mouth. She can feel her fingers again, and they hurt. L. Her hair has gone fully white by the time she finishes the saga. Relola is as thin and bent as a crook vine these days, still as tough and flexible, too. And he still hunts in the tangle wilds, alone. Is this simple stubbornness, or his own crooked path to Oalateleoal? That is his own business, and not Damya's. She reads it to a gathered crowd across two nights at Sweet Marrow River. Slabs of loilolo sit on plates untouched. Not a cup clacks against table, not a murmured word. The gathering doubles in size from the first night to the next. As much of a crowd as the tavern has ever seen. Relola sits at the front, nodding in rhythm to her words. They listen. They do not drink the forgotten wine in a rock. They drink her words. And what words they are. What freedom comes from the constraint of choices. What flexibility in the similarity of syllables. The smallest shift in inflection changes everything, rewrites the entire story. The tale dances in and out among the listeners. The characters dance through the Kretloalaratoe world. Damya's imagined heroes and heroines ride the winds through the northern wastes. They clip over the waves of the great storm seas like shimmerfish. and they even fly to the stars on wings stolen from arrowbirds. A breathtaking flight, harrowing and exhilarating. But in the end, they return to Earth, as all must do in the end. That is where life takes root, after all, not in the interstitial spaces between. She finishes late into the second night. Her voice has turned into a red bird's croak. There is no round of formal applause. That would have been due her in the chambers of the Imperatrix. Though, of course, her last work, Meditations, was never formally presented there. Her prosecution was the only acclaim afforded her then. A fulfilling reward and a terrible one. Instead, here, there is a long moment of silence after the last vowel fades. Then someone in the back stands up and tips his chair unceremoniously over. More movement then. A flicker to her left and right. A crescendo of fallen chairs sweeps the room. She knows she has seen chairs tip before. She cannot remember if it portends good fortune or a forthcoming brawl. She hopes it is nothing serious. She has no courier pilot to seduce this time. She has not enough extra canisters of fuel in her ship to make it all the way back to Ambit space. She braces herself for whatever's coming. And then the first woman steps up and insists on buying her a drink. Three more follow, and more after that. But Damia's head spins. She turns them down with words of gratitude and modest embarrassment. She cannot remember ever having undressed herself down to bare honest modesty in the wake of a reading, but it feels good. Like having a young woman's face to turn toward the sun one more time. Later, the chairs have been righted, the bread broken, and the drinks downed. She takes Relola's arm for the long walk home. Longer every month, every week, Damia thinks. He praises her to the moon and back, crows over her clever meter and her sinuous story. The stars spin overhead and the treetops bow in close. So close, Damia feels she cannot breathe, and that she does not need to breathe. A swirl of words expand and shrink in her lungs. Neither of them speaks one particular praise aloud. This masterwork story of Damia's runs much to Ale's tastes. The Kretloalaratue language does not suit itself well to discussions of contingency, and the Kretloalaratue culture does not suit itself well to taking things past and turning them over and over, to looking for new ways to wound oneself with old hurts. There are always new hurts for such a purpose. Sometimes Tarea, Relola sighs, in the lee of her courier craft's sleek fins. Sometimes I look at you, and I see something very like the light of humanity in you. Tarea, Kretloala born Tarea, who came to us 20 years younger. He clasps her shoulders briefly. He lets go. His fingers brush the strands of white hair lying on the back of her neck. They are so brittle and come free of her braids so easily now. That, Tarea, is so wise and so very well loved. But you are a gift, too. She remembers the day, perhaps a year past. She remembers the day she offered to marry him. She thought that it would be good to have a reason to move out of the ship, to share one loneliness instead of splitting off into two. A specific and limited sort of intimacy. Relala's old eyes look with longing at the young men and women in the marketplace alike, at the plait-wrapped crowns and braided flower-strewn beards. Damia's eyes have only ever sought out a certain kind of body. That hardly matters now, as little flesh as either of them have left. But Relola reacted with shock, politely covered disgust, a hoarse but gentle reprimand. Relola stoops to kiss her knuckles now, and all the old embarrassment plays out again in Damia's mind. She loves Relola, and he loves her. She turns this fact over and over, but she cannot find a place in her heart where it fits. She decides not to make room for it. Finally, he lets her go and bids her a good night. Damia lies in her bunk. She has lain in this bunk for 10 years now. Her eyes find the porthole, and she numbers the same strange stars, the same flat horizon cut by broken towers and not gleaming spires. It is no more wrong tonight than it ever has been, and no less either. She waits for sleep to visit, and her patience goes unrewarded. A. There are many words that mean goodbye in Cretloal Aratwe. There are specific ways to bid farewell to acquaintances and lovers, parents and business people. There are suffixes that specify the season and the tenor of the relationship being parted. Some make it clear that a swift reunion is desired, while some are equally clear that it is not. Others are more opaque and leave the possibility to chance, to fate, to the gods who watch but do not interfere in the ways of their people. The word for goodbye that Damia will use is Akeokeoteloa. Akeokeoteloa will signify to Relola a certain warm regard, a respect granted between equals. This will offend him, or at least annoy him. Surely Damia should know better by now. She does know better, and this is why she will close the door on him with this word above all others. She will wish him Akeokeoteloa, and that word will tell him that she does not expect to meet him again in this lifetime, though it offers up the heady fragrance of potentiality, that nothing is truly knowable, that there is no future that can be perfectly predicted. He will go to the captain of her ship and tell her that Damia is gone into the next life, that she is not dead, but gone, with equal finality. She will write Akeokeoteloa in each syllable, that her stylus scratches will close one door a little farther, will prize open a long-shuttered window. She will wait to transmit the note until she has cleared the tangled wild vines that have overgrown her ship's landing gears, until she has tested and double-tested the engines, until she has retaught herself the management of the pilot's console and the navigation station. She will send this note, and she will not send the others that she has written and rewritten. She will not send a note that says that for all Cretloala is beautiful and welcoming, it is cruel and withholding. She will not send a note that says she is not content to remain a coddled house cat in her last years, that she wants to be a person again, whatever that is worth, whatever that costs. She wants to be warmed by a sun whose face is as familiar as dreams of childhood, and she wants the starry holes punctured in the night sky to match up to the gaps in her heart. She will find a way to make the amends she does not know how to make, and she will answer the questions that fall through her fingers like the fine soft dirt of a forest floor. She will fall down at sorrow's feet or at her grave, or at the unmarked trench outside of the Coliatura if she must. She will do this, and she will not come back. A message from Xaro has never flitted to her out of the Ansible, on broken wings or whole. This could mean anything or nothing. Xaro's silences have always been terrible. This one is too full of possibility. Damia cannot find the words in any language to write meaning into the blank space she holds. One day soon she must put ink to page, collapse the wave function, find out on or under what world Xaro waits for her. But not today. There will be time enough for that. She will fly low over the home she has known, and she will tip her wings in greeting. Akeo keloteloa, that gesture will say, and Relola will look up from his tablet in shock, in grief, in understanding or something close to it. She will not see him when she looks down among the trees and the slate rooftops, though she will try. She will not feel angry or sorrowful, but some teetering point halfway in between. The way between worlds will be long, and there will not be enough fuel. Her extra canisters were used and discarded on the way here, and there is no more to be had on Kretloala. Her path home is a prayer and a gamble. She knows this before she cuts away the first clinging vine, before she holds her breath and switches the engine on to see if it remembers its true nature and purpose. Not a home, but a vessel. The engines will gutter when she is still so far from home, but there will be life in the environmental system for some time yet. While she waits, she will edit her meditations. She will find the pieces that were missing the first time through. She will reforge them better, not with the blaze of truth delivered on the ambit's white-hot sword, but with the strength and flexibility of the crook vine. And she will turn on the ansible and call out in the darkness, into the ambit or what remains of it. And she will ask if she has earned the right to come home, to tell her story and the stories that she has learned, to serve in the truest way she knows, and in the fashion that she once understood and wishes to understand again. She will bend under the will of the new ambit and strife of its people, and above all else, the suffering of Ksara. But she will not break. She does not know what lies ahead of her now, but she stretches her arms out toward it gratefully. Damya will go home again as a refugee, a victor, a pilgrim, a human being. If there is something more that calls to her, then she will be that too, and she will write it in her heart with all the names she can devise, in any and every language where it can be found.
And there you go. Huge thank you to Amy. Thank you so much, Amy, and Summer. That is fantastic. What a story. Thank you indeed. So that is Starship Sofa put to bed again. We are heading once more into deep space, and we will see you in 2 weeks. So I'd just like to say good night from me.
Thank you for listening.
I don't get out much. I've barely left the ground. I'm tuning in to your transmissions. I'm rooting, waiting to be found. And I'm building rockets, pointing them to the moon, but the work is going slowly. It won't get to you anytime soon. Can you reach me? Is my signal getting through? Turn on your radio, I wanna talk to you. This signal's going light speed. By the time I get my say, I might already be on to you and on my way. But you're so far from here, and at best I'm moving slow. So I'm waiting on your call at home with nowhere to go. Can you reach me? Is my signal getting through? Turn on your radio, I wanna talk to you. I wanna talk to you. Myself on a radio wave, I might get to you someday. If books were rocket ships, I'd need only the will to fly. I'm still building word by word, and I'll get out there by and by. I'll get out there by and by. I'll get out there. I'll get out there by and by. I'll get out there by and by. I'll get out there.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.